Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It is Tour Live, Neil Atkinson with John Gibbons, Paula Murphy and Harriet Pryor. Harriet, if you're watching this live, is beneath a big clock. If you're listening to it, you now know that there's a big clock involved, counting down the minutes for Harriet through this Tour Live experience. We're being produced by Andy Heaton. We're going out on all the platforms at once as a live. And we've decided next season, John, that Tour Live will have a set time and a set day for people to get excited about. Is that right?
Yeah, we've moved it around a bit to sort of suit the fixtures and to keep everyone on their toes, including us, it seems a little bit, but I think people would like to dedicate a bit of their time each week and to be able to enjoy it live, to get the comments in and to sort of do it a bit more like a radio show. So we decided Friday at 4 o'clock was a good time for everyone to Skype.
Yeah.
No one's putting any meetings in.
Absolutely not. Or do put meetings in, but do this.
Yeah, just pop something in the calendar, something cryptic. Acronyms are good, aren't they?
Oh, great. I use them all the time. Get away with murder. No one knows where I am. Elusive, like the Scarlet Pimpernel. Go on, John.
Yeah, so 4 o'clock Friday. We're looking forward to it, aren't we?
Yeah, we are indeed. So that'll be from closer to the start of the season, I hasten to add. Don't be thinking definitely 4 o'clock Friday next week. I haven't got a clue what's happening at 4 o'clock Friday next week. But as we approach the Charity Shield, I think 4 o'clock Friday will be the appointed hour for Tour Live. Community Shield, not Charity Shield. Leicester, not Wembley. No one's going. It's tons of spares, the King Power that day, absolutely tons of spares. Harriet Pryor, Paula Murphy, already mentioned coming up on the show from the Hillsborough Survivors Support Alliance. I've got Tony Cottier and also on the Anne Williams Golf Day, which is happening now live. I've got no idea what the leaderboard's saying. Is he?
I don't know.
Oh, God. I was excited there. I was frisky. It is. Oh, Nikki Cornish is going to the Charity Shield. Nikki, you've got a lot of content to do. There is...
Four on the whistles. Take some wigs, Nikki.
Yeah, to take some wigs, different voices, stand on a box. There is... yeah, also coming up from the Anne Williams Golf Day is I've got Steve Martin talking about that wonderful charity and all the brilliant work it's doing this year. So that is across the board. Excellent stuff coming up in the inserts in this Tour Live. If you are just enjoying it as a live, though, we are going to talk about Liverpool's forwards, what's gone on there over the course of, the whole calendar year, really, because Diaz is an aspect of this as well. And on top of that, we'll be discussing our rivals, what they're up to, the comings and goings there on the day in which Richarlison leaves Everton Football Club in order to join Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, who helpfully have a somewhat anonymous picture of a bird on their crest. So when he does the daft dance, it'll feel all very appropriate as that works all the way through. So that is still to come. Exciting indeed. We will start off though with an acknowledgement, Paula, that Minamino's gone this week, and I do want to spend a moment dwelling on Minamino in a second. Origi confirmed to AC Milan, which is really pleasing and good to see. Minamino ends up having an important season for us, Paula. I'm pleased for him. I'm pleased that he genuinely has had some terrific Liverpool moments. I always like the idea that in the end, a time at Liverpool improves a career. Minamino improved Liverpool last season, top scorer in both domestic cup competitions. But these are goals that will have to be replaced.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I felt watching Minamino's time at Liverpool that if one player was affected by COVID, it was him. Yep. I think he arrived just eight weeks before COVID hit. And obviously he didn't have good English and he just arrived, unfortunately for him, at the worst time. I mean, we knew what he could do because we were on the other side of it. And there was a hope that he was going to come and do that for us. And I think he suffered from issues with lack of crowd, lack of continuity, lack of games. But I think what we can see for what he did last season was he knew what his role was going to be. He accepted it. He didn't complain. He didn't moan. And he was an important part of the foundation jigsaw puzzles that allowed the rest of the team to fit the ones that made us get to the final and push us so close to the league. I mean, in seasons gone by, we'd have had 14 players, 13 players, and he'd have been number 14. And by the time we got to May, we'd have been relying on him in the league. But the squad depth is so deep now that I would put him at sort of 17th, 18th, and he didn't get a sniff. And where he did help us was in the cups. And I think he knew that he had that role to play. And I think probably he was thinking about leaving a few months back. And he just made that role his own and knew how important of a part that was. So very grateful for what he did. And, I, there's a great picture of him with both cups because he was like, yeah, well, this was the bit that I did. I'm not grabbing anything else, but I'll grab these because I think I can.
He could indeed, John. You know, the goal against Leicester, obviously, it's in a really weird way. It's a bit of a season changer. You know, I think the jot or two at Arsenal in the League Cup and that goal against Leicester, it was arguably Anfield's biggest moment of the season, which is a strange thing to sort of think, given we break 90 points and we win two trophies and we get to a European Cup final. It's a bit funny to think that in a really weird way, the Taki Minamino goal late against Leicester was Anfield's finest hour for 2021-2022.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? We've done a lot of things looking back on last season and things, and Leicester in the League Cup comes up a surprising amount considering, you know, the tournament and considering, as you say, Neil, that we played every possible game we could and bigger games, bigger opponents. But yeah, it was a great night at Anfield and he played a huge part in that. And like Paula says, both cup runs and, you know, there's a really nice moment on the pitch at Wembley after one of the finals where Jordan Henderson, you know, encourages him to take his moments in front of the fans with the trophy and they're all sort of, you know, going mad as he does the arms up in the air and that's nice. That shows shows the team spirit, but also shows that the value in each other and the remembering the moments that just sort of got them there. Really, He was effective last season, but I think he's probably looked at it like Paula says and says, well, I didn't get loads of opportunities last year. Next year, it's going to be even tougher because of players coming in. And, you know, obviously Diaz comes in the January, which pushes him down even further. So I think he's been realistic and I think the club have been fair, you know, with both him and Divock. But yeah, they've got plenty of good memories in a Liverpool shirt. And that's what you always say, isn't it? You want everyone who comes to Liverpool to get a positive experience out of it. And I think Taki, after some, you know, tough start, like Paula says, definitely has.
Absolutely. Harriet Pryor also came to Liverpool, hopefully getting positive experiences out of it. There's Minamino, Origi and Mane have gone. It's Diaz, Darwin and Carvalho who are coming in. Liverpool have got five, therefore, proven quality forwards. Salah, Jota, Diaz, Firmino and Darwin. The couple of young lads, Carvalho and Cade Gordon. I'm finding, because, my first Carvalho experience was Ricardo Carvalho. Yeah. And you'd always said his full name. I'm not saying Ricardo's making it harder for me to say Carvalho. anyway, Carvalho and Cade Gordon are the other two who I think will be backing up those five proven quality forwards. It's worth remembering, isn't it, Harry, that Diaz obviously comes in January, but he's part of joining in with these other areas. Do you think that there's enough in there from Diaz, from Darwin and from Carvalho to replace the goals of the three who've left?
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of unknowns around it, isn't there? And I think that's what maybe is leaving us a little bit hard to gauge where we're at, because a lot of these players we've not seen play before. We don't exactly know where Carvalho fits in, whether he's going to be a forward or whether he's going to be a bit more of a midfield figure. Some of the younger players coming through, we don't know the role that Klopp envisages them to play. So I think that's why maybe as fans we can look at it. And if you go through all the names that we have, you'd like to think, yeah, there's plenty there, especially if you're looking just at the league and Champions League, because you'd like to think you're going to play the similar sort of players, and then maybe when you're thinking about the FA Cup and League Cup, is it realistic to go on a run again like we did this year without that, you know, some of those more squaddy players going? I'm not so sure, but I think for the league and Champions League, it will be absolutely fine, and they'll be the priorities next season, won't they? But it is a bit of a shame because it feels like we've had all these incredible squad players and that incredible squad depth, and then some of those players are starting to go, and it's difficult to find players who will come in and accept their role like Origi and Minamino did. Like Origi just was happy playing the part that he did, and Minamino, you sort of felt like, was the same. So how are you going to replace those figures who can play the odd game and come off the bench when they needed to?
Do you think the idea, you know, for me, this is serious renovation, Harriet. You know, you look at this, you've got, it's three out and three in, effectively. Yeah. But the age range is fascinating as far as I'm concerned. You know, you've mentioned there, obviously, Darwin is a younger figure, but he's not a young player. He'll expect to get a number of games, you know, probably matches up with, to a degree, the sort of the Mane element in there as well from the second half of the season, at the very least. Diaz has obviously joined and got a lot of games last season. You think that that'll continue. Carvalho is interesting to me because I think that there's this idea, isn't there? You know, Carvalho and Gordon, they're there to prove themselves. So I think it's a separate dynamic, isn't it? To the idea of Origi and Minamino, who probably knew this is what we are. Mm-hmm. The strange thing about Carvalho, and even to an extent, perhaps still Darwin himself, and maybe even Diogo Jota in a really weird way, mm-hmm. they're still here to fully establish themselves rather than accept their reality, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and I think actually that probably works in your favour, because if you've got someone like a Minamino or an Origi that knows that they're never going to break into that starting front three, I think they always accepted that that was their fate. They never thought that they were going to displace Salah or Mane or Diaz or whoever it was before that. And so maybe, you know, you saw Minamino come on and take his chances, but and Klopp always said he trained really hard, but I think he'd accepted his fate. And then you look at some of the younger players coming through, like a player like Carvalho coming in knows he's got everything to prove, you know. He knows that people aren't going to expect to see him lots next season when he immediately comes in, but he's going to want to take every single chance he gets when he is called upon. So it's a different kind of squad player. It's less the experience, isn't it? It's less of, okay, you know your role, you know your job. It's more, okay, you can come on, have your chance, but you've got to prove yourself and prove that you're worth taking the chance on for future seasons.
It's interesting, isn't it, Paula, that this renovation, and it is a renovation, sort of in it. I think in our minds, we to an extent had a, you know, the idea that there'll be a BC AD moment around, oh, it's now a next phase with Liverpool, mm-hmm. whereas this sort of stuff's dripped through a little bit more than anything else, and I'm intrigued by that. You know, this does appear to be the way Liverpool are going to do it. There's not going to be some sort of big summer where it's seven out and five in, and everything's different now, but things are actually quite different now. You know, three of our likely frontline next season for some games weren't playing for us on December the 31st.
Yeah, it's really something to think about. I mean, I'm going to say this only because I have not had the chance to say this to any living person, because I don't live anywhere near Liverpool fans. But I'm still really worried about Salah. Because I'm just really worried that we're not going to let him go on a free next year. And if we're not going to let him go on a free next year, what's the other option? So I'm still really concerned that the people we're talking about today aren't actually going to be the people that we are looking at in August. And so that's another thing to consider as well. I mean, I was quite taken aback by Mane going, because I didn't pick up on it towards the end of the season. I really didn't pick up on it. Maybe, again, because I'm getting different media. But it does feel like that what my thoughts are in regards to the way Klopp has changed the way we transfer as a club is that he's almost becoming a much better chess player, in that what he's doing, he's making a move, not for the next move, but for the move after the next move. And because of his stature and his experience and his currency as a manager, people are perhaps thinking about coming to us at a different stage in their career than they would have thought about 5 years ago. So whereas we picked up Minamino and very quickly, whatever the reason is, it's irrelevant, but very quickly we put him in the pigeonhole of squad player, we're now getting very young prospects who everyone wants, who are almost standing in line, putting their hands up, going, pick me, I'll be a squad player. Because they know that whatever happens to them, even if they don't make it as the Liverpool first teamer, they will leave us a better player because of their time with him. So I think the dynamic of 26, 27, 28-year-olds packing out the sort of, you know, the ludigretes away might be a thing, but we are now going to have younger people. I mean, I think Carvalho, Cade Gordon, and you've got Elliot as well. There's another little dimension of three amazing talents that are all with us at the same time, that could all be in the same team at the same time, driving us forward. And it's that in itself is going to be interesting for people like Diaz and Jota, who might be dropped for a League Cup, see what they do.
It's in the comments, a couple of things are interesting, John. Belinda, hiya, Belinda, says that Carvalho said in an interview at the end of the season his target is to be in the World Cup squad, so maybe he kicks on sooner than we're expecting. Rodri also asks the question around Cade Gordon, significantly more minutes next season or about the same. In the world of one to watch for pre-season, my actual name is Cade Gordon.
Yeah, it is an interesting one with him, and I think for both of them, I think their target has to be to convince Liverpool that they need less forwards next summer. Because I take Paula's point, Paula's terrifying point, that there might be a twist in this Mo Salah.
There's another twist in the Mo Salah tale, you know.
What, did he sign any contract?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's say he leaves.
There's two twists.
Double twist. Who saw it coming? Not me. There's a chance. Okay. Well, let's say that the most likely scenario is that Firmino and Salah move next summer, twist aside. So that's two forwards going. Now, Liverpool have obviously got a choice of, do they replace both of them? Do they replace one of them? Or do they replace neither? Now, neither would get hearts racing on Twitter.
Feel frisky.
Let me tell you. But that sort of decision is in the hands of Cade Gordon and Carvalho. And that's, you know, what they'll be looking at this season. And if I was, you know, working with them, with their agents or whatever, you know, you'd be saying to them, you know, convince Liverpool that they don't necessarily need to replace both of them next season. So the idea of, you know, someone maybe comes in for Salah, but, you know, they're relaxed about Firmino going and not getting a Firmino like him, because they've got these two young lads who've proved this season that they're on an upward trajectory and that they are going to be the required quality for Liverpool. And so that's the challenge for them, and I think they will have games to prove it.
Okay then, excellent stuff. This has been the start of Tour Live. If you listen to it as a podcast, what you're going to hear now is two inserts. The second one is Steve Martin talking about the Ann Williams Golf Day and the wonderful charity work that it does. Gone through that all the way through with Steve. Do check that one out. But first, I've got Tony Cottier from the Hillsborough Survivor Support Alliance. Now, Tony speaks about his own experiences on the 15th of April in 1989. I'm saying this because part of what the Survivor Support Alliance looks to do is to improve and strengthen people's mental health who went through the experience at Hillsborough. And as Tony even speaks about, they've started to be referred some people who went through similar experiences in some senses at the Stade de France. I'm putting all of this in because I'm saying all this now because I just want to be really, really clear that if you're not in the right place to listen to this, which is perfectly understandable and perfectly legitimate, do feel free to spool forward 10, 15 minutes or so and find the conversation with Steve and come back to listen to the conversation with Tony on another day. Where the Hillsborough Survivor Support Alliance tomorrow are doing is it's a huge charity walk, 21 miles. We're going to do some of it, me and John. We'll be on at least some of it all the way through, and we'll be producing some content on the Anfield Rap social media from there as well over the course of that walk. So you can find out more about it then. You can donate to it too if you go to their website, which is hsa-us.co.uk. I'm saying, giving you all this information. I do it at the end as well, but I'm giving you now in case you don't want to listen to this bit, but you would like to feel as though you could donate or get involved tomorrow. So it's a 21-mile walk. As I say, we'll be doing part of it. Lots of people who are much braver than us will be doing all of it, all the way through, but we will at the very least be doing the opening. So here is me. But as I say, please do consider your own mental health. Consider where you are before this. Here is me talking to Tony, first of all, about the walk tomorrow, and then moving on with Tony talking about his experiences and how the Hillsborough Survivor Support Alliance has helped him. Then there'll be Steve Martin. Then you'll be back with us. Neil Atkinson, I am joined by Tony Cottier from the Hillsborough Survivor Support Alliance to talk about the walk that I'm doing at least some of tomorrow with Tony. Tony's doing the whole thing. Let's talk about the walk first and foremost, and then we'll talk about the cause. Tony, it is quite the trek. Anfield to Goodison, easy bit. Goodison to Marine, Marine to Aintree Racecourse, Aintree Racecourse to the training centre, the training centre to the McDonald's on East Lancs Road, which feels as though it's there for morale. And then from the McDonald's on East Lancs Road right the way through to Anfield, that is 21 miles. It is a big trek.
It is, yeah. Not much looking forward to it, to be honest. Looking forward to having a laugh along the way and meeting loads of people and, you know, hopefully, you know, the social side of it I'm looking forward to, not necessarily the work.
I'm in your team, which is good news. We're starting out early in the morning at 9:30. It's been a long time in the planning, this, hasn't it? Time in the planning, Tony.
It has, yeah. And the reason why, you know, it's been done, it's organised by HSA. They've organised it to raise funds primarily. And it was well organised before the European Cup final. And the importance of HSA has come into the spotlight over the Stade de France and the debacle that happened there. And what they do for people's mental health and the support that they give people is fantastic. And it's proven its worth, because LFC and Spirit of Shankly have referred people to HSA. So not only is this walk, which was primarily to raise funds, it's now, you know, it's raising the profile of HSA and making, you know, people aware of, you know, mental health in the whole, you know, it's good.
The idea of how important this collective support is, Tony, it can't be understated, can it? You know, in terms of allowing people still to come to terms with what happened in 1989. And as you say, you know, there's now obviously a more recent and thankfully an example which didn't lead to anyone dying or any very, very serious injury. There were some serious injuries, but very, very serious injuries. There was, you know, the importance of all of that, of people being able to commune with each other, people being able to speak. It's core to what the Survivor Support Alliance does.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to harp on about myself, but, you know, after the 89, obviously, I a bit of background to it, I was pulled out of Pen 3. I was in a bit of a state, so got home, managed to get home on special, got picked up. People didn't know whether I was alive or dead. People trying to get me information. You know, back in the day, you couldn't just pick a mobile phone up. And it was quite traumatic for everybody, my family and whatnot. And when I came home, you know, I was received as, you know, like almost victorious, and that messed with me head a little bit. But then Monday morning, my uncle got me up to go to work. I was apprentice. You know, just his words, the world doesn't stop turning, you've got to get up and get on with it. And I did. It's exactly what I did. Just threw myself into life again. You know, I don't want to mention the paper's name, but all the crap started coming out. So, and I just... The survivor's guilt that I had was, it was almost like, you know, it was doubled down on by the way, you know, as we know about the, you know, the cover-up and whatnot, and the lies that were told about us, and I just buried it deep down. I didn't know this at the time. I got on with life, and life sort of took over. I got married, I finished my apprenticeship, got married to my lovely wife, Lisa. I've got two wonderful kids. I've had, you know, my fair share of illnesses as well, and I was bumbling along in life in Hillsborough, you know, it was always there. I'll be honest with you, you know, we'd go to the match. I stupidly gave up my season tickets as well. How ridiculous is that in 94 before they went all seated? But when I do go to the match, I can't sing You'll Never Walk Alone, or I couldn't ever used to, because I just fell up. And I just thought, oh, you know, that's associated with Hillsborough and stuff like that. And I just got on with it. And then it was 2012 after the Independence Inquiry come out, and Margaret Aspinall, you know, we all know many, many campaigners, but Margaret Aspinall in particular came out and looked directly into the camera. And I felt she was looking at me. I was listening to the news all day. I got back from work. I locked myself in the lounge. The kids and my missus kept me, left me to it. And she looked into the camera and said, "You weren't to blame. As a survivor, you weren't to blame." I mean, I'm not going to go into any graphic detail, but we all know what happened, and we know what people went through. People have horrendous experiences. And I buried that really, really deep. But when she said that, it was like, it wasn't an epiphany, but just everything come out. I unraveled, I think. I just unraveled a little bit. got myself together. I sobbed all night. You know, I'm a joiner by trade. It's rough, tough construction work. You know what I mean? You don't talk about mental health and traumas. You know, it's not something that people would want to talk about. You know, in spite of, you know, now we know that in the construction industry, suicide's one of the biggest killers of, you know, men under 55. Yeah. But that wasn't spoken about back then. But in 2012, when that happened, I just sort of, everything changed for me. Really deep-rooted feelings come to surface. And I didn't know where to go with it. I mean, I've become a contract manager now, so I drive around the Northwest to different sites and stuff. And there'd be a trigger song on it. It could be anything. It could be a song from the 80s or the, you know, early 90s or something. And boom, I'd have to pull over because I'd be sobbing. Stories or, you know, listen to Radio Merseyside and something would come up about Liverpool. It could be totally unrelated to Hillsborough. Boom, that would be a trigger. And it was getting more often. And, you know, I like a bevy, like a lot of people do. And I was getting dead sentimental when I was having a pint. I mean, I'm sentimental anyway, I'll be honest with you. But even more so about Liverpool, you know what I mean? And it just couldn't carry on. I knew it couldn't carry on. So I was on Twitter and I seen someone had retweeted something from the HSA. So I followed them and I looked into it. And I got in touch with initially Peter Scarfe, and he invited me along to a meeting. I came to the meeting. It was at Anfield, at the club host of meetings for the group. And I met all survivors and witnesses. And when they say, see, I have a thing about, like, survivors, it's even now, even after the therapy, you know, I did survive it, but I don't like that tag, but it is. And, and you know, Peter will probably go crackers with me and Diane will go crackers with me, but that's how I feel. But the people who, because I was in the middle of it, I was fighting for my life, you know what I mean? So it wasn't like, I wasn't witnessing the trauma. So I often feel, for certainly the people in the top who were looking down, I often feel about them and people, it must have been helpless. You know, your natural reaction is to help people, in it. You know, some people did, they help people up. But so I was in the middle of it, fighting for my life, and yeah, I suppressed all of the things I've seen and done. But so it's not just about the survivors, it's about the people who witness it. Even people on the telly who had family there, you know what I mean? That's a trauma in itself. You know, there's Forest fans walking with us tomorrow who were there, and they have got in touch with Peter because they're having trauma, and it's an impact that, you know, it's impacted people in all kinds of ways. So it's when I met the group, things started making sense, and it was really good. I'm a big coward, like, I'm a bit of, excuse me, language, I'm a bit of a shithouse when it comes to stuff like that, you know, it's like rough, tough construction work. And I had to take the missus along for moral support, like, she's only 5'1". I'm 6'3", but she was there beefing me up. But, yeah, and, you know, she took me along, she came with me, and it just all started making sense. I felt comfortable. I was in a room with people who knew what I'd been going through, who had been through it on the day and stuff like that. And it was great, and having more regular conversations with Peter when I was feeling triggered and stuff. I mean, I would get sentimental when I'd have a drink and I'd be drunk tweeting, and, you know, Peter would pick up on it and get in touch with me and say, "You're all right, you know, do you want to chat?" And he got the patience of a saint. I mean, he's a joiner like myself, but he'd chat with you for an hour, just calming you down and making sure you're all right. And eventually he convinced me to take the therapy, which is the Hillsborough Transformational Recovery Model. And I was dead sceptical and cynical as they come. And I was saying, oh, I don't know, you know, what if it become a basket case, it unlocks all kinds of dark stuff and that. And I've got to say, the treatment is over four, it's 4 hours over four different meetings. I've done it on Zoom with a local psychotherapist who actually designed the treatment with Peter and Diane, because they tailored it specifically towards Hillsborough, because a lot of survivors had had therapy in the past and it hadn't worked, you know, and it was so unique. I was made to feel so at ease. And the first session, I'd done this test. It's a legal test to measure trauma and post-traumatic trauma. So I went through the test and I answered it honestly. And I think Pat, who'd done the therapy, Pat, she's fantastic, absolutely wonderful woman. And she said, legally in a court of law, if you scored 25, that's a diagnosis of post-traumatic. And I think I got 57. And it knocked us, honestly, because you take the knocks, you're all with the knocks. I mean, I've had bleeding cancer twice. I don't want to sound like Niles Rogers, but two times. You know, and you get on with it. And that's how I've sort of been, the sun always rises and you've got to get up and you've got to have a go. But I was gobsmacked on it. And she left me for over a week to deal with that, because that in itself was a bit of a trauma here and that. And I didn't know. But obviously, Peter and Diane and other people could see it in me, I'll often refer to Peter and Diane. They are brilliant, brilliant people. They do this fuck shit, you know what I mean? They don't do it for any other reason than to support people like themselves who've been through this trauma and have nowhere to go. So we form this group, you know. And I was a counsellor and I'd done a speech regarding the Hillsborough Lord and support for Middleborough Council support. And yet again, you know, it's with no support from the state. Survivors, like the families and like, you know, the bereaved, they had to sort it out themselves. And thank God Peter and Diane did. And, you know, there's so many people who've been through this treatment out there, well over 100 now. But I had the therapy was on the, I think it was the second sort of meeting. And it was quite straightforward, really. And boom. That was an epiphany. I can say everything sort of changed in me. My whole sort of perception of how you deal with things and stuff. And it's a rewind therapy, basically, but it's very specific. And it worked between the third and my fourth session. I had a trigger, a real trigger. And I was in Spain. I was driving my friends to an airport. I was driving back, a song came on the radio, boom, that was it. And the treatment worked. I remember, I keep doing this because I've got young Tony, 18, who went off to Hillsborough. He's on my shoulder, he's always with me, I brought him back. I know that sounds really weird, and it's not mumbo jumbo or hoodoo. And it just lifted. And I can talk to you now. I mean, I would not be able to talk like this about Hillsborough because I'd just been bit and I couldn't, you know, talk about it to people knew, family, close family knew, and I talk about it to people who knew me. So a lad on the day who saved my life when the bar went, he quickly managed to get me up. And there's photographs of it when I'm facing backwards. I didn't know any of that, you know, until you look back. And he's dealt with it in his way. But he won't speak about it and he thinks, oh, it's done and bad. And he's buried it. And I know he could benefit from the therapy, but just trying to get him. He's 51. He stayed in his life. You know, it's everyone has a different way of doing it. And I always thought, oh, there's no way. I'm not cynical at all. You know, counselling in my mind was something that you just talk about something that much. And obviously I can talk, but you talk about something that much, you just get fed up of talking about it and it doesn't become an issue. But how simple is that? Of me, but it's changed my hold. I mean, like, I can think, you know, you'll never walk alone. I don't have to turn it off. And if it come up on my playlist or whatever, I'd quickly turn it off, or to turn the radio station over, or, you know, if it was like a background music on a documentary, I'd have to turn the documentary off. And it now it's not a problem. I mean, I've moved on. Hillsborough's always been there and it always will be there. And, you know, that's not gone away and that's not changed. I mean, feelings around Hillsborough haven't changed, but it's how I can deal with them feelings now, you know, so, and I've processed the trauma, if you like.
So for this walk then, it's raising funds for more people to be able to go through the transformational recovery model. There's also the fan support and food banks are turning up at 9:30 at Anfield. Yeah. If people want to come along and just donate to that, wish people well as they're leaving in the morning at Anfield. That is possible Saturday morning. It is, just to be absolutely crystal clear, the 2nd of July. Yes. Saturday the 2nd of July, fan support and food banks from 9:30. We all set off at 10. And we want people to donate some more money so that people can go through this transformational recovery model, the HTRM, Tony.
That's it. Yeah, that's the one. And like I say, it's become even more relevant after the Stade de France. Like people who, you know, have got nowhere to turn, have been in touch with the club, been in touch with Spirits of Shankly, and they've been referred to HSA. And that's, you know, the value. I mean, mental health in particular, you know, it's now, it's become, especially after COVID, but it's not like, you know, a dirty word. People talk about it, you know, in my circles in construction, you know, we've got mental health first aiders and on site. If you recognise someone who's struggling and stuff, it's raising the whole awareness of mental health and making it not a taboo subject or not, you know, yeah. You know, as we know, there's a lot of macho nonsense in the construction industry, and people won't, and you know, they'll bury it deep down, like probably I did as well. But it's raising awareness of what they do. It's raising awareness of mental health, and it's raising awareness of the impact of trauma and how to deal with it.
Okay, so the walk is tomorrow. On Saturday. If you do see anyone, if you see people in the Liverpool area, you happen to be around and you see people doing it, feel free to wish them well. Obviously, donate. The donations work like this. Well, first and foremost, there's a Twitter page, at Hillsborough SU1. That is in there as well. That links to a couple of different crowdfunders, whether it's Just Giving or GoFundMe, there on there. And there is the website, hsa-us.co.uk, hsa-us.co.uk. And through there, you can also donate to the Hillsborough Survivors Support Alliance. I can't thank Tony enough for speaking as honestly as he has over the course of this, and that's what this is, so much of this is indeed about. We will thank Tony, and we'll get on with the rest of the show. Joined by Steve Martin from the Ann Williams Golf Day. 10th anniversary, Steve, 10 of these. Did you ever expect that? You must be absolutely shattered.
Not unexpected, just very, very humbled and proud of what we've done. I said it last year when I come on, I said this day was created to remember Anne's legacy and everything she stood and fought for after losing Kevin at Hillsborough. But it's gone beyond that now, to an extent. We're now supporting charities all over Liverpool, all over Merseyside. And in Anne's memory, it couldn't be going any better. The family come support the day for us. They've been so grateful of what we're doing in Anne's memory. It's not a golf day, it's a full event. People turn up, we have Anne's flag flying high from the golf pole, the golf course pole, which in itself is a testament to how the golf club treats us on our day. It's just a very, very special day, really is.
It's this year, you always specify a charity, you do a different charity. The charity you've chosen this year is just a remarkably... you said before, use the word humbling. I see a lot of what they do. They're very good at making clear what they do. It is the Inclusive Hub, it started back in 2016. It helps small groups of autistic children around Kirkdale take part in non-contact boxing and fitness sessions. Looks like inspiring work, to be quite honest with you, Steve.
I've seen firsthand through what the Hub do through my own son, and they've always been on our radar for a couple of years, and I was going to put them forward to the lads last year, but in my head I thought, no, I'll keep them for the 10th one, because it's such a special service that they provide for families who need it, the parents who need that respite, because when you do have children who are on the spectrum, it's hard work, and I don't think until you're in that bubble and you understand, or you have family or friends whose children are the same, people don't realise how it affects your day-to-day life. So the fact that this service is there to provide the kids a fitness and give them some discipline, but also give the parents a couple of hours respite, it's a remarkable service, and it makes me very, very happy that we can do this for them.
When you're talking about what it is you're able to do for them, what will this directly involve? I know they do community hampers on top of all the other work they do. You know, what will this involve? If people look back on it, they'll think that was what the Ann Williams Golf Day brought to us.
I'll be honest, I don't think that's from my place to say. When we make the donation to the charity, they will do with the money as they please.
So it's unsecured funds, and they can just cut loose with it, and they'll make the right decisions.
They're not even making the right decisions. The decisions they make are already right. That's why we picked them in the first place. We have certain boxes that we look for what charities, but we'll never ever pick a mainstream charity, because ultimately they don't need our X amount of money, but we'll always go to the smaller charities who go about day-to-day lives trying to make a massive difference to the people that they support and the communities that they provide for. Kirkdale, it's a bomb. It's not the best place, let's be brutally honest about it, and the fact that this little beacon of hope and support is there for the people in our community, not just the children with disability, they put job hunting events on for parents who need the support. They have coffee groups, they have coffee mornings, so when the children in school, the parents can go and give themselves like a support group. All them little things are what we look for, because without that, people suffer. And we're not the time we're in now. Everyone needs to look after themselves. And if we can give any charity a little bit of a boost to help them continue the brilliant work that they do, that's all we want.
When you talk about the work that you do on this, you don't do it all alone. Stay, it's worth saying 10th anniversary. You've got Gaz, you've got Andy, you've got Sean, you know, and there's a group of people who support you over the course of the year in order to be able to bring this about.
Yeah, we have our whole sponsors every year. They pay X amount of money just to have their logo on the whole. We don't charge a great deal for it, and realistically, we probably could charge more now. It's 10 years of events. The event's grown and grown and grown. As we all know, costs are going through the roof. The club needs to make their money as well as we need to cover our costs. But every person, like the trophies give us a discount because we've been with them for 10 years.
Yeah.
The programmers do the programs for cost. All them little things add up to the final donation that we can give to the charity. So even though it's a golf day, there's so much work that goes on behind the scenes. We have our ambassador, Wayne Scholes, who just is mind-blowing the generosity this man gives us. The prizes are off the scale this year, I swear to God. When I tell the lads the story of how we got this prize this year, there will be a gasp in the room. We've got an official supporter in Radical player, Tiddle Hatton. He gives us amazing one-off limited edition prize every year. We've got all sorts of bits and bobs from all over. Some of the phone calls I've had this year, I've got companies approaching us now saying, what can we do for you? Could they want to be involved in our day? It's a testament to the lads who supported from the very, very first one. There were 32 players the first year, and every one of them still play this year, 10 years on. We're now up to 80 players. We have 25 caddies come, and we have about 150 people coming in the night. It's not just a golf day. The golf day gets in the way of a good bevy. it does, because you turn up, the sun's 9 times out of 10, the sun's cracking the flags. You know, LFC TV come and do an amazing job for us. They broadcast our event to an audience that we could only dream of. Obviously, we do Twitter, we do Facebook and this, that and the other, but the platform that gives us and goes on the official LFC website, it's stupid. From a little idea on an internet forum, what do you think about doing this, lads, to 10 years down the line, thousands and thousands of pounds raised for the amazing charities in our city?
What's the weather looking like on Friday then?
One thing we can't control is the weather. So if someone needs to throw an umbrella to get around for 4 hours, then clap on.
With it then, you know, you're saying it's going from strength to strength. Listen, if people want to get involved in terms of support, is there an email address or a place to go to?
We've got our PayPal address, which is annwilliamsgolfday@gmail.com. We've got our Twitter page, which is AnnWilliamsGO2. We've got our Facebook page, which is AnnWilliamsGolfDay. I'm on Twitter. Andy's on Twitter. Sean's on Twitter. There's ways to be involved, but to get in the actual event, it's harder to get on this than on a season ticket waiting list for Liverpool. And I'm not saying that. We could probably run this event over the course of a weekend.
Yeah.
Because there's that many people want to be involved. When it went out last year, people from South Africa messengers, can we play? People were going to travel from South Africa. I went, mate, you're having a laugh, aren't you? I said, I wouldn't let you. I'll let you fly from South Africa to put. That's the level, and that's the pull that the LFC website give us now. Because Liverpool is such a global fan base, the people all over the world want to be involved. We have supporters in America who send us a cash donation. Obviously, Wayne's based there and everywhere. It's just, from four little lads trying our best to do something nice, it's gone beyond anyone's expectations. I can't thank everyone enough, from the person who threw £2.50 in the Just Giving page the other day to the £200 donation we had last week. Every penny is going to go to an amazing, amazing charity, and for the 10th year, it couldn't be better.
Brilliant stuff from Steve, the AnnWilliams Golf Day. Just I'll reiterate some of those links. There is a Just Giving page if you want to be part of that. It is justgiving.com/crowdfunding, all one word, and then /AnnWilliamsGolfDay. All the stuff is out there on socials. We'll give it a shout as well. As you're listening to this, it is happening. It will be ongoing at this key moment on Friday. The prizes are absolutely off the charts. Early pressings of Half Man Half Biscuit records and all sorts of fantastic stuff in there as well. It's also just a brilliant thing, as Steve says, everyone involved should be proud. And it's 18:02. You were indeed back with us. Excellent stuff indeed. Thank you to Steve and to Tony for giving up the time and coming in and having a chat. All very, very, very good indeed. Joined still with Paula, with Harriet, and with John. And John, you know, Richarlison leaves Everton. But once Everton has touched you, things will never be the same again. He'll still be in his heart and in his soul. He will still be born. He was not manufactured. That's one of the many things they say about the Brazilian forward, Richarlison, John. But he now plays for Tottenham Hotspur, who've amassed quite a tidy little squad over the course of the summer. They've added themselves Bissouma, Forster and Perisic. They're strongly linked with Jed Spence, who for a football that I think I've only seen kicking about eight times, I've heard so much chat about, it's ridiculous. They've been the busiest so far of everyone. People are sort of moving the pieces around. There's a lot of sort of chat that they could become a bit of a threat to us in City. What do you think of firstly Spurs' business and likely business? And do you think that they could amass a point or that could concern Liverpool and Manchester City?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it's going to have to be a big jump, but then we made a big jump 1 year. What I'd say is even bigger for them than the players is the manager, and I think they've got a top-class manager who, you know, is one of the top five in the world, in my opinion. And so I think when you've got a manager like that, you know, you're telling people, you know, you're serious business and you're there to do something, and I think he wants backing to go there, and it looks like they have backed him. I mean, Perisic is a really good footballer, although I haven't seen him very recently, if I'm honest. So I can't give...
Well, he played against us.
Of course, yeah. So I have. There we are. I didn't watch him then.
Play wing-back, which I think is quite interesting, because I think that's where Conte may well use him. He was wing-back against us, and he made that left-hand side with Bastoni work quite nicely. I think Bastoni's a really good player. But he gets up and down, but what I would say is he is 32.
Yeah, well, that's it. But I think, you know, it is a big thing to do that jump for where Liverpool City are. So in a normal season, you'd be saying, oh, maybe Spurs can challenge. But because Liverpool and City, you'd expect to get 90-plus points again. That is the challenge for them. But as I say, we did it, you know, in one summer, we jumped from sort of, you know, low 70s right up there. So it is possible, and they've got the manager and they'll have some belief that they can do that. But whether that's possible is a tough ask.
Paula, do you feel as though that Tottenham can make that much of a jump in a season? For me, one of the key things is when we make the jump between 17, 18 and 18, 19, which is the jump that John's referring to, we were already, and we went through 17, 18, not least because we get to the final. We had Champions League football and we had that lived reality of what it's like to go big midweek game, big weekend game, big midweek game, big weekend game. What I think is interesting for Tottenham is that they had a little bit of European football last season, but effectively pissed it up the wall. And then the second half of the season, they had nothing. They had weeks between games. And that's what makes me think this could just be a bit of a stern test, especially with the way the schedule is. But what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think they can. I mean, the problem with Spurs is, and I don't know if Conte's the man. I mean, I was absolutely gobsmacked when they got rid after the Champions League, because I thought he did a great job for them.
When
they got rid of Poch, because I just thought, you know, I don't see anyone else. I mean, maybe it was because he thought, well, maybe I can't take them any further. I mean, no one else has taken them that far. No one for a long time. So, you know, but I just think that until Kane goes, they are not going to fundamentally change. And unless Conte is going to square up to Kane and tell Kane to do what he wants... And because what it appears to me is Kane has been able to dictate the method and the manner in which Spurs have played, and that has not always been for the benefit of the club. I mean, you know, we've got players that are immensely and immeasurably better than Kane, and they get put in their box on a regular basis. And I don't mean in a bad way. I just mean that they are absolutely not in charge, and they know it. And he just rules the roost a little bit, apparently. So, you know, under no, he as a coach of sports teams and as someone with a very basic interest in sports psychology, he broke every rule in the book by telling the press that he was fit and demanding to be played in the Champions League. That for me meant they were done, and I knew they weren't going to win. And I just wonder if this is going to end, if this ends up in a bit of a gunfight between Conte and Kane. If Kane can be railed in, maybe. I'm not sure, though.
They've got goals in them, Harriet, is the thing to say. Kane is part of that. Son last season matches Salah for top scorer. Richarlison scored 11 over the course of a campaign for a side that was much threatened with relegation and who never really performed. You're in there, Kulusevski comes in second half of the season, does well, grows as it wears on. That's the thing that Tottenham do carry. A lot of football on the counter is the thing I would say, and if sides are taking them even more seriously because they've got additional firepower, they might have more and more teams to have to break down in their own 18-yard box.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. It depends what sort of style they're going to set up with next season, because we saw in the games against us and when they played Man City that they're clearly capable of getting a result, not just against teams in the bottom half of the table, but against the top sides. But is that actually going to translate to success over a 38-game season? I still don't think so. And I think if you're looking at the players they're bringing in, it still feels to me like they're focusing a bit on the short term. And I think they're aware that maybe the manager that they've got, they're not going to have for that long. I don't know what his contract situation is, but I think he's made clear this is a sort of short-term thing. And it feels like the players they're bringing in sort of support that. Do I personally think that's going to lead to them having success in the long term or even this in the next season? I don't think so. I think it's a level of consistency with Spurs that seems to be missing. And yes, they've done good transfer, you know, good work in the transfer market so far, but I just don't think that they've done enough or are going to change their style of play sufficiently that they're going to challenge next season. And look, they could prove me wrong, but the manager's obviously very talented, but I don't think it still matches up with the squad that he's got, with the aims that he's got as well.
Okay. City, John, looks like Sterling, Ake and Jesus are all on the way. Jesus to Arsenal. We'll loop back around onto Arsenal in a second or two. Fernandinho's gone. Haaland, Alvarez confirmed. Phillips looks done. Zinchenko could be out. If he is, Kurakella looks likely to come in. I can't work out if City is so strong. They could be the best team in the world. They're vying for it with us. So the idea of strong is almost difficult to say. But the one thing they are is certain. If everything I've just sort of described there goes through, they are certainly different, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, and potentially light in certain areas as well. And I did a call with David Mooney, and it was a fiery show sort of review from the season. But because we did it a little bit later, we inevitably ended up talking about the summer and what they'd done and what it looked like they were going to do. And, you know, he said that in a funny sort of way, they've gone from having a season where we're like, oh, we look pretty good, but we could do with a number nine, to suddenly having two. But he thinks there'll be various points next season where we're like, oh, we could do with a bit more quality in wide areas. Do you know what I mean? And so, like, and so they don't look like they're going to go in with a necessarily a bigger squad than they had last season, which was quite a tight one, albeit filled with absolute superstars and brilliant footballers who can play in different positions. But it was reasonably tight for a team with their resources. They look like they're going to do similar, but with, you know, strength in different areas. And as you say, Neil, sort of a different focus. I think Phillips is a better player than people seem to be saying. I've seen a lot saying, oh, you know, it's a lot of money to spend on someone who isn't going to play. I think he will play. I think he'll get plenty of games in City's midfield, certainly if they change, you know, how they set up slightly. So I think he'll play a lot. But I don't know. There's a lot. I think one or two more might go. Might add to that, really. And if they do, you know,
Gundogan's got 1 year left, Mahrez has got 1 year left, and Bernardo Silva is just perennially linked away.
Yeah, always seems to be just about to get off.
Yeah, and then it's player of the year.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting one there. So there might be one or two more there, and that, you know, might leave them a little bit light, certainly in terms of, you know, people who've won stuff for them.
It's interesting, Harriet, isn't it, that they just seem oddly transitional for a side that just broke 90 points and came very, very close to winning a Champions League, or at least getting to a Champions League final. We've just sort of discussed us, though, being a little bit more transitional than maybe people think, or more sort of continually renovating what we're about. But I'm not even entirely sure, almost like a preferred formation for Manchester City at the moment. And that's the one thing there's always been real clarity over. Whereas, you know, if they do sign Phillips for a lot of money, will there be a lot of a two and a one in midfield with Phillips sitting next to Rodri and then only one ahead, but then one spear ahead in the attack? Someone's just put in the comments, they've lost a lot of pace with Sterling and Jesus leaving, although Haaland is not slow and I don't believe Alvarez will be either. But, you know, it is this slightly strangest situation for us, while simultaneously still thinking, well, they'll break 90 points. Because that's what they do.
It doesn't feel very Guardiola, does it? I think he has to deal with a lot of certainty. Like for us, it feels like we're kind of used to dealing with the uncertainty every transfer market. We have all these younger players. It feels a bit strange that a manager who likes, you know, we see whenever he talks to the press, he likes to know exactly what's going on with all his players at all times. Oh, can you hear me still? It's telling
me. Yeah.
Telling me there's an error. Anyway, you can still hear me. Something went wrong, it says. Yeah, it just feels a bit, it feels a bit too transitional, like you say, for a team that's broke 90 points yet again, won the league. I don't know if they're just really going to be focusing on the Champions League and they're thinking maybe they need something a bit different to win in that competition. It's strange. I think the Pep was saying all last season he wanted a striker, even though I personally thought they were playing fine with a false nine and they had loads of goals in them still. They brought two in and then they're letting other players go, and it's going to be interesting to see how they set up. But they're going to need to change the formation, like you mentioned, to accommodate the new players, and especially with Haaland coming in. Like, how's that focal point going to work? Where's the sort of feeder going to come from? Where's the pace going to come from outside of that? It'll be interesting, and I think it will work to our favour, especially in the early parts of the season, that they'll still be figuring things out when normally they approach a season knowing exactly what's going to happen. The formation is clear, like you mentioned, and they know they've got everything lined up.
For me, what's really interesting, the unspoken thing about City, Paula, is Harriet started speaking there, and the first thing she says, it all feels a bit un-Guardiola. Guardiola's only got 1 year left. And he said he's not really interested in talking about his contract over the course of the season. Now, that might change. And obviously, there's the big elongated gap that is the World Cup slap bang in there. But to me, the two number nines and Phillips feel a little bit like recruitment for a manager. Like, this will just improve a squad. They don't necessarily feel very Guardiola. And, we, you know, we talk about stability. One clear area that Liverpool did get stability over last season was that Klopp did extend from 2024 to 2026. Everyone knows Jürgen's way till 2026. That's where we are. I'm really intrigued by the idea that City, Guardiola, even if he's making noises internally, like, yeah, I'll sort it, don't worry about it, it'll be no problem. City have got to have maybe the vague idea that they might not be there for the start of next season.
I'll be surprised if he's not there for the start of next season, but I would
sorry, not this, not 2022. Yeah. I mean, literally 2024.
No, no, no. I almost wonder. I mean, look, someone like Guardiola's at the top of his game. He's a globally recognised. You could put your hand up and say he's in the top five or the top three managers in the world. But he hasn't won the Champions League, and he's tried and he's tried and he's tried with City, and he's spent money and they've spent money and they've changed the formation. And you just wonder if he's just going to say to himself, right, I'm just going to be professional, finish my contract, and then I'm going to do something completely different, or I'm going to move. But in order to not upset the apple cart here, I'm just keeping my mouth shut. I don't know what his incentive is to stay. I don't know what he's staying for. It's not money. I don't think he's, I think he gets paid handsomely well. But I just wonder that he's whether he's sort of conceded almost that he's not going to win the Champions League with City, and that's all that's left. And if that's the case, I might as well just call it quits and go. I just wonder.
No, I think there's every chance that that's the case. It's fascinating to me that I in my head, I heard that his contract was up in 2024, and then you check it and you're like, no, it is 2023. Mm-hmm. And it does seem that, I think, you know, we'll spool through the other three quite quickly, John, but on this, I think this is the, you know, in lots of ways, City's behaviours sort of become a little bit more crystal clear if you were to frame them in the idea that they do have to at least partially wonder, will this fella still be at our club for the start of the 2023-2024 season?
Yeah, it does make a little bit more sense, that's certain. And there has to be uncertainty, because if there wasn't, you know, he'd have sort of signed on. So, you know, even if he's sort of given noises that he might do, like Paula says, you know, makes a good point there. He might be just looking at, well, see what I do next season, see how the team looks, you know, see how I get on. You know, if he gets that Champions League, elusive Champions League for both him and City, is that enough to round that off? It is one to watch, but yeah, it's a possible theory, you know, on the players coming in, certainly.
I'll spool through the other three, because firstly, there's a fair bit of madness knocking around. Paula, Arsenal, they brought in Vieira. He's just very, very likely, might actually be announced whilst we're doing this show, or might be announced this afternoon. They look like the only horse in the Tielemans race. They're looking at Martinez at Ajax. They've got a lot of work to do, I think, Arsenal, from the point of view of they're going to have European football. We all know what the schedule's going to be like. And they really didn't have that many players, you felt, as though the manager thought he could rely on towards the end of last season. So no matter what happens, Arsenal are going to have to recruit and get bodies.
But for some reason, there's a lot of players that seem to want to join them at the moment, which has taken me completely by surprise. I didn't see that.
It looked fun at the Emirates last season, is the thing I would say. It felt like you were part of something. Do you know what I mean? It felt a bit on the march.
Yeah. I, you know, Jesus is going.
Yeah.
That's confirmed. I mean,
I'm confirming it.
Okay. Well, you know, you are as ITK as anyone, but
I mean, get a tie on under that jumper.
I didn't see that either. I knew that City were going to lose a few players, but I just think that, you know, they went through a really rocky start at the patch at the start of the season. They lost a shed load of games at the start, and you know, he was being questioned as manager, and they were like, "Oh no, it'll be fine." But now they all seem to be want to join Arsenal. So it does look like fun. It reminds me a little bit of how we were around like 2007, 08, 09, when we were having a good go, but we weren't entirely sure, and people were coming and going, and we got good signings, but they didn't stay. And then so, you know, it does look interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they get on. They'll be 100% not wanting to get spanked at our place again. So let's see how that goes this time.
I think buying into the Arsenal project, though, I think players coming in, they're just sort of like, yeah, I think this could be the. I think they've got a lot of talented young players, haven't they? That are clearly coming through, and then people are like, let's give it a go. Like, let's leave Leicester. Why would you not? Let's have a go at Arsenal. See what happens.
It looks more fun than United, yeah. Harriet. Although we've heard a lot that Eric Ten Hag. Eric Ten Hag's got them in at 9 a.m. though, which, you know, maybe the Anfield Rap could work on. He's got them in, and it feels as though they're shedding people before they will add. De Jong, it looks as though he's going to go to United. Supposedly, he's saying, Ten Hag, he doesn't want that many in this summer, which I think is quite wise, to be honest with you. I think the idea of getting to work with and have a look at everyone is you know, something that could work for them to an extent. He's got to start somewhere. It feels like another funny season for United is in the offing. That's not to say it'll necessarily be bad, but you do think he could possibly do with a couple more.
It's going to be a season of, we talked about transitioning earlier, it's a huge one for them, and I think it's going to be one where their fans just have to accept that it could all go really wrong again. I think that's the reality they're going to have to live with for a couple of years, and they're just going to have to buy into it a bit, because the manager, fair enough, I think he's done the right thing. He's wanted to come in, he's wanted to assess everyone, and also just look at people's work rates. I think that what he's spoken about, he's like, right, people aren't working hard, then I'm not going to just include them in the squad. And there's certain players who I feel for United have just felt like their place was a certainty, even though they've not been performing or training particularly well. So it's going to be one of those where he's like, right, who do I actually want to keep around here? And then from there, you assess the market and assess the options that you have. So I'm surprised that they've not aimed to bring in a few more, especially towards the end of the window, but maybe he just genuinely wants to have a season where he's like, let's see, assess the situation, scan it, next season I'll do the business I want to do, and hopefully he'll be thinking they'll give him the money to play with to be able to do that. Also, Salah's agent's tweeting and people are getting annoyed by it, and it's a...
What's he tweeting?
He just tweeted another little laughing, crying eyes face again, and it's just like, people need to stop getting annoyed.
It's a big problem for me, this, Harriet, because, as you know, a man in my early 40s, and in general, I'm shit at emojis. So I don't know what any emojis tend to mean, to be quite, apart from smiley face.
Yeah.
And maybe, I mean, I very rarely see it, love hearts. But sort of, the cry. No one knows what the fuck that means.
No.
No, you know what I mean? That's not getting annoyed by things that literally are devoid of all any and all meaning. Speaking of which, John Chelsea, it looks like an absolute madhouse from the outside looking in. You and I were just happened to, we were in a pub last night and the Sky Sports News was on. And as you were sat there, you were thinking, anything could come up here about Chelsea. Absolutely anything. Who's buying the players? The owner appears to have made himself interim sporting director, which is always quite the red flag. you know, the whole thing to me looks absolutely mad. They keep wanting to buy players who just look like Hakim Ziyech again. Lukaku's gone out on loan. It just looks like a madhouse from the outside looking in. This fella, I don't think, has noticed they've got no centre halves, because all they're trying to do is just buy wide forwards.
Yeah, and they've already got a lot of them. It is very strange. like running in late to try and sort of steal deals they've been worked on for ages and things like that. You know, I like that that they came in for Richarlison late with a player plus cash offer, even though Spurs had tried that about seven times. Yeah. Everton had said, no, we're fucking skinned. You know, we need the money.
Have you heard of FFP?
And so they were like, oh, looks like he's going there. Should we try a player plus cash offer? He loves the trade. Bless him, doesn't he? It's all very Moneyball and the film rather than the actual sort of concept. I'm not sure if he's applying Moneyball principles necessarily.
Do you like the film?
I do. Yeah.
I watch the film a lot. not for any reason. It's a good film to watch whilst you're doing some work.
Yeah.
It's a nice film. I'd pop it on in the background like a screensaver. And I mean, this is the highest possible praise. That and The Big Short, I watch a disproportionate amount of.
I like he gets the first base as a, just an analogy. I like to use in other things.
Yeah.
Harrier Pryor gets the first base.
Excellent stuff.
It's a good analogy.
Talking about
it's merely a metaphor, don't be worrying.
It means to get the job done. So there we are. But anyway, Chelsea, yeah, it's mad, and they could go in with any sort of squad next season. It looks like it's
fucking right. It is, Scott. Go on,
it certainly looks like it's gonna be unbalanced. Is this live? Yeah.
It does look like it's going to be imbalanced. Listen, it's a slightly chaotic tour live. I hope you've enjoyed it all the way through. Thanks very much indeed to Harriet and to Paula. And thank you very much indeed to Tony and to Steve in the middle as well. Andy Heaton for producing, all of you for the comments as they've gone all the way through. They are always useful, even if we don't always refer to them as directly, as we just referred to Scott there. Regular time for this coming, but not straight away. Don't get carried away. Don't get excited. We shall see you very, very soon indeed. It is the Anfield Wrap. Download the app. See us live on stage in London a week on Saturday. I've got spare tickets for LCD Sound System tomorrow night in Brixton if anyone fancies them, and I might be able to do you the Guns N' Roses one too. This is the way in which we use this platform these days. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.